procedures to go through, structural arrangements. The first one is to see how many of you were able to bring a copy of the Bhagavad Gita today. Let's see. You have a copy of the Bhagavad Gita? Okay. Who else brought a copy of the Bhagavad Gita today? No, that's not the question. That's not the point. I'm asking who today brought a Bhagavad Gita that's different. Please bear with me. I try not to be too sharp, but I know what I'm doing. Okay, good. All of you are mature enough to understand that when you use consciousness, it draws energy. It draws psychic energy. So that the colloquial image of someone who is conscious is that of an archer, and someone who is very good at shaping consciousness is like the astrological sign of Sagittarius. And very often consciousness itself is symbolized philosophically by an arrow of intentionality. So that all of these are indications that consciousness draws energy, not like a plug and a cord drawing energy continuously, but takes the energy in a burst, and the effect of that energy in that burst carries on in an integral fashion, so that instead of having a current, one has a pulse. So that psychic energy in consciousness has a different form from psychic energy in nature. In nature, psychic energy is a current. In consciousness, psychic energy is a pulse, totally different, has different effects. They are, in fact, different phenomena. They are different to each other in a complementary way. When one of the kinds of psychic energy are extant, the other kind is background, or another way of saying it, using psychological language, when one of the modes of psychic energy is phenomenal, the other is noumenal. So that in nature, consciousness is a noumenal, invisible background. But in consciousness, nature is the noumenous, invisible background. So that one has to be very circumspect. You have to be wise as a serpent about this. That you cannot just confuse the two distinct different modes and hope to grow. In fact, if there is a confusion of modes, you will always spin your wheels. You will always come out dead even. It doesn't matter what you do or what your intentions are or how hard you pray for it. If you do not distinguish between the two modes of psychic energy, they will cancel each other out, just like particle and antiparticle. You will come up with some total of nothing has happened. So that most people do not grow after they reach the maturity of being able to supposedly handle their own affairs because they do not distinguish accurately enough the universal physiological basis of psychic energy. Just simple misunderstanding. So that in real wisdom traditions, yoga of many varying kinds was instituted to help make this distinction. In the I Ching, in the ancient Chinese way of looking at it, you have yin and yang. The yang is a natural current psychic energy. The yin is an intermittent pulse psychic energy. They are complementary. They are different. They always work together. In terms of the real, they always work together. So that consciousness and nature are always occurring, even if you had 100% of nature and 0% of consciousness, they would still be working together. Or conversely, if you had 100% of consciousness and 0% of nature, nature would still exist. For instance, in very powerful, complete, deep samadhi, nature, for all intents and purposes, no longer counts. The Japanese symbol for this is to just have a blank page. It's not just limited to Japan. Long before Takuan did the blank page for the 10 bulls in the classic Zen illustration, 500 years ago in the West, when Montaigne did his tarot deck in the High Renaissance, Hermetic Renaissance, the spirit of psyche holds up a completely empty sphere of consciousness. When one is in the sphere, nature is completely empty. When one is in nature, consciousness is completely empty. You can see a lithograph of this in the kitchen. I have it up on the wall there by the light switch in the kitchen, just in case someone gets to that point of being able to see that symbolic imagery. When you go to turn on the light in the kitchen, there's the High Renaissance image in the original powerful tarot matrix of Montaigne 500 years ago, of exactly what one finds at the apex of experiential discrimination in psychic energy. Now, we are working with consciousness. We're working with pulse form psychic energy, commonly called consciousness, but more technically should be called thinking consciousness, thought, mind. Mind is a pulse phenomenon. It's not just that neurons and neuronal groups fire to produce neural connections. That's the actual nature of the whole process. You can think of it in this way. The neural system works by pulse, and the blood system works by flow. So that in nature, blood is a very good symbol of the way in which psychic energy works. But in consciousness, neural energy is a very good symbol for the way in which psychic energy works. So that thought and blood are two complementary symbols for the behavior of psychic energy in its fullness. And to bring thought and blood together at the critical juncture is to identify the true altar of transformation. So that, for instance, in the Roman Catholic Mass, the blood is transformed into light. The blood is transformed into the highest frequency of thought. Now, the efficacy has nothing to do with the Roman Catholic Church. That's gross egotism to assume that it has something to do with our vestments and our history and everything else. In view of every other planet in every other galaxy in the universe, it's meaningless what the Roman Catholic Church claims. but the universal principle of nature and consciousness having an interface that works transformatively is true everywhere. Everywhere. So we need to understand that we're trying to mature ourselves. We're trying to lift ourselves out of a Neolithic morass that is suffocating, and anyone who stays there will die. The symptoms of drugs and violence are just the beginnings. Anyone who stays there will die. There will not be another generation of human beings that live in the old way. That's it. But in order to do this, requires growth in a real way, maturation in a real way. Now, in our second year of dealing with consciousness, dealing with pulse form, psychic energy, in its four-phase fullness, in its quaternary structure of fullness, we've come to the fourth phase, science. It's a completing phase, just like symbols were a completing phase. Symbols complete nature. They complete the current of nature. Symbols are the epitome of the blood flow of wholeness. Science is the epitome of the neuronal impulse fullness. Science is consciousness raised to its zenith, and symbols are nature raised to its zenith. So that there is a complementary correlation between symbols and science. The correlation is between nature and consciousness. In fact, the correlation is between two modes of psychic energy. So when we look to try to understand where we are now, we can look at it ideationally in terms of thought, just as I've been speaking. But to characterize it in thought, even though the thought subsumes the idea of nature and the symbol of blood, the actual truth is that they are subsumed under thought. And one cannot be content. You cannot stop in any realistic way when seeking to be real. You cannot stop with thought, no matter how subtle and inclusive thought seems to be. So that I'm trying to provide two different non-thought, two different natural penetrations symbolically today to try and temporarily get you outside of this very powerful ideational frame of reference that we are creating for ourselves. Your health requires it, and the integrity of the educational program demands it. I need to make the frame of reference very, very strong. I need to make the idea very, very strong. The idea of science, and further the idea of science as the completing quaternary in a whole phase form expression of pulse form psychic energy, consciousness. So I realize the ethical import of someone taking this scale of responsibility. And so I'm making sure that the frame of reference does not corral you. You need to be free. And so I'm punching two little holes with Vajra diamond drills today in that powerful frame of reference and ideas, so that if you do happen later on to realize the power of these ideas, they will not trap you. is very, very difficult on this scale to get out of this kind of entrapment. One reason that I don't teach directly in a personal way, one-to-one, is because I know how hard it is to deal with these things. And the successful dealing with them, getting really good at these ideas, is the worst of all possible situations. You need to retain, for your own freedom, a little bit of a sense of the pebble under the mattress, so as to not to go to sleep. Okay, the first hole we're drilling in is with the I Ching. The second hole is with the Bhagavad Gita. Notice we're not blasting holes. We're not making big gaps. We're not destroying the power of the ideas. But we're drilling through so that we can get a perspective, get a sense of freedom, and use these powerful ideas. And I must say, they're very powerful. Who was it that said that nothing is more forceful, nothing is stronger than an idea whose time has come? And the arrival of this idea is coming along. It's coming along very, very, very quickly now. So the first hole we're going to punch through is with the I Ching. And keeping in character with the nature of the I Ching, we're not going to talk about the I Ching, but we're going to use the I Ching itself. So that the object lesson of this particular hole is in the use of the I Ching. So the only legitimate use we would have is to ask the question, what are we doing? And look to see, how does the I Ching characterize what we are doing? What is it now in total that we are doing? How would the I Ching characterize that? What would its answer be, to use a colloquial kind of phrase? The question is, what are we doing? The answer is, the I Ching says, hexagram 42. What is hexagram 42? Is increase. Increase. But those who've been following this program realize that the hexagram always occurs, as in any Taoist expression, as part of the five-phase energy cycle. So that hexagram 42 is just 20% of what really the I Ching is giving to us. It's an important 20%. It's the middle fifth in between two other sets of fifths. So if you use the hand again, notice the wonderful symbolism of the hand. You can use a hand, you can use a star, a five-pointed star. The most archaic was the hand. The hand is the natural symbol of wisdom, which is why I use it, because it's the base of wisdom for the last 50,000 years. You can see Australian Aborigines still using the hand. You can see in Paleolithic cave art, Lascaux, and so forth, the hand. It's the most ancient of all symbols of comprehension. It's a natural symbol of comprehension. Whereas the star is a conscious symbol of comprehension. The hand belongs to nature. The star belongs to consciousness. And one of the most ancient of all writings that we have are the cylinder seals from Sumer, and some 5,000 years ago you see the five-pointed star, just like the Celtic star. The Celtic star is not from Ireland, but comes from who knows how far away, probably around the 4th millennium BC, in the roots of ancient Sumer. So the star is the proper symbol of civilized consciousness, whereas the hand is the proper symbol of primordial mankind. Civilized mankind tends to use the star, and natural mankind tends to use the hand. It's like that. I don't want to say primitive people because they're not primitive at all. There's nothing primitive. 3 million years ago, man's ancestors were still not primitive. So in the hand, hexagram 42 is the middle finger. And it's surrounded because it's in a flow. It's in a phase form flow. It's in a five-phase flow. 42 is surrounded by 41 and 43. But that surrounding puts 41 where the thumb is and puts 43 where the little finger is. So that we have the first, the third, and the fifth. Notice that when you say the first, thirds, and fifths, that you're speaking of musical kinds of proportions. When you have thirds and fifths added to notes, then you begin to have a kind of a harmonic possibility in your scale. So that the root of the phase flow is not only hexagram 42, but it's 41, 42, and 43, but in this kind of splayed, articulated order, 1, 3, 5. The second and the fourth positions are determined by examining the central hexagram, 42. In this case, hexagram 42 had two moving lines. It had a moving line in the fourth place and a moving line in the fifth place. So that those moving lines are able to be converted to their complement. And when one does that, one gets from hexagram 42 with the two moving lines, you get hexagram 21. So that 21 occupies the fourth place. It's 3 is moving towards 4. The moving lines lead from 3 to 4. So that the hexagram in the fourth place is 21. Now coming back to 42, examining it, and you can do several different kinds of examination. You can take the inner trigrams and the outer trigrams. You can take various aspects of it. The easiest, most comprehensive way is to give it an obverse disc change everything into its opposite. Because the obverse energy of any particular hexagram is the kind of imprint matrix out of which it can emerge ultimately. So that the obverse of hexagram 42, the negative from which this print is made, is hexagram 32. So that when we did the divination by Rice, and we got hexagram 42, we now have the five-phase energy cycle complete. We have 41, 32, 42, 21, 43. Now just read the names of them translated into English in the sequence, and you can immediately form a picture of the arrow. All right? But we're making the arrow not through an ideational characterization, but through a current, natural, blood flow type level. It's only when we translate that into language now that we begin to be able to form an idea of what this is. But the idea has in no way planned out what this is. So that the idea is just now expressive of what has already happened on a natural level. Okay? This is the sequence. Decrease, duration, increase, biting through, breakthrough. Now you can go to your I Chings by yourselves, and when we go into the course beginning again in January, we'll start with this sequence. We'll start with Thoreau's walking, and we'll take Thoreau's walk into this hexagram of the I Ching, and that's how the two-year cycle will begin. All right? All of this is one little hole drilled into this powerful idea of how science fits into the ecology of consciousness as its fourth and culminating phase. We'll put that aside, and we'll come now to the Bhagavad Gita. This is hole number two. And we'll come to the sixth section of the Bhagavad Gita, which I suppose most of you have had a chance to look at in your own regard. Notice how we're not taking a textbook approach at all. Textbook approaches were good 300 years ago. They're not much use to us now in the old form. We've moved enormously beyond that. We're not reading the Bhagavad Gita. We're using the Bhagavad Gita in a special kind of a way, a yogic way, incidentally. We're selecting out the dynamic fulcrum of the Bhagavad Gita, the sixth part out of 18, the part at which the hand would grasp it, at which natural feeling tone consciousness would grasp it to throw it as thought consciousness. And we're going to grasp it in a very special way. For those of you, some of you grew up on farms still and still remember how you milk a cow. You can't just grab the udders. There's a special way that you milk the cow. You start with the upper finger and work down, and you squeeze it that way. And this is how you milk a cow. Otherwise, you're going to have some problems and a mess. This milking motion like that is also a symbolic way of the phase form of grasping by accumulated penetration. Instead of just gimme, which is stupid, and anything subtle will not be there. As soon as anyone does that, it's not there. Just the shell, the husk is there. But what is it really is gone. But if you grasp it like milking the udder, in a phase form, accumulative penetration grasp, then what is there remains there for you to understand. So we're going to grasp, in a milking way, the sixth part of the Bhagavad Gita, which means that we're going to start this week, and for the next 4 weeks, we're going to grasp it ever more firmly, but in this kind of a milking motion. So today we'll take the first 12 slokas. Next week we'll take the first 12 plus the next 12 slokas. The third week we'll take the first 12 plus the second 12 plus the third 12. And then the fourth week, which will be the culmination of this whole sequence, we'll take the first 12, the second 12, the third 12, and the last 11. because as any good wisdom text should, the Bhagavad Gita in the sixth chapter ends without completing the circle. There are not four 12s. There are three 12s and one 11. The fourth 12 is the illumination of the whole structure and does not count as a part distinguishable from the whole. It's a moment of reflective or reflexive illumination. So that we're going to take the sixth part of the Bhagavad Gita in a four-week sequence and end the course in this way. And by the fourth week, we'll be able to characterize to ourselves in pulse form psychic energy, known as thought, the realization of what we have been doing. And if you're following it, if you have done it these past 2 years, you'll be able to see it. In your mind's eye, in your mind's ear, it should occur right there. Was ZT say, I'll be right there? That's what the Lord says to Arjuna. If you stop arguing with yourself, if you stop fooling around with phony things, if you go inside yourself right there, that's where I am. You keep thinking you're talking to me and that I'm out here. I'm right there. And the dialogue with God ends with realization, because you no longer project the dialogue out, but you reach a point where golden silence. God can hear you before you speak. This is why in the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus tells people who go to churches that they're hypocrites. He says, indeed, they have their reward. Take yourself to where you live and go inside to your silence. God hears you before you even need to speak. In a way, all churches are bastardizations of the spiritual process. All churches are bastardizations of the spiritual process. Sometimes they're necessary, but when you're growing up, there's no room. Part of the Bhagavad Gita, the first 12 slokas, the first 12, I'm using the Juan Mascaro translation because it's succinct. And in connection with it, I'm using R.C. Zahner's Oxford University translation of the Bhagavad Gita, because some of the language is a little bit difficult. Here's how Juan Mascaro begins it. Krishna is speaking, and he will speak all the way to the 33rd sloka, where Arjuna will come in and say something, and then Krishna will reply. Arjuna will reply to that, and then Krishna will end it. So that if you were to outline what is the form of the dialogue, it's five-phase energy cycle again. Everywhere in the wisdom traditions, you'll find this. Krishna, Arjuna, Krishna, Arjuna, Krishna. It works in that fashion. So the sixth chapter, structurally in the Bhagavad Gita, is a very particular form of the dialogue, a five-phase energy cycle. The first is so important because beginnings are important. It takes 32 slokas. And the last four sections take just 15. Very, very often it seems like the preparation takes most of the time, and in fact it does. Two-thirds of the whole path are just getting ready to take the first step. That's like in this educational program. It takes at least a year and a half before you even begin, even ready to move in any kind of personal way. And of course, if you haven't prepared yourself, the first impulse to move, the history section, collapses. If you had a fragile structure, it won't move. If you had a static structure, it won't move. It doesn't take the stress of momentum at all. And of course, this is the big problem in our time. Psyches are so fragile because they're made as imitations of faulty models, and they don't move. They're only good on drawing boards in churches. Krishna says, "He who works not for an earthly reward, but does the work to be done, he is a sannyasi, he is a yogi. He who works not for earthly reward, but does the work to be done, he's the sannyasi, she's the yogi. Not he who lights not the sacrifice fire or offers not the holy sacrifice. If you're busy lighting the sacrifice fires and making the holy sacrifices, that is not it. Whatever it is, it's for sure not that." Here's the Zener translation. "The Blessed Lord said, 'The man who does the work that is his to do, yet covets not its fruits, he it is who at once renounces and yet works on, not the man who builds no sacrifice fire and does not work.'" So there's a kind of a double entendre in the first sloka. Instead of saying, well, it isn't lighting the sacred fire and it isn't making the sacrifices, they put it in a double negative. Not he who lights not the sacred fire or offers not the holy sacrifice. Why is it put in a double negative? Because this is high dharma. One's not pointing to things anymore, but one is gesturing to the fullness, which includes not only the thing, but its context. And so very often, high spiritual expression at this point, instead of being in a labeling, designating mode, it's in a double negative. You might have heard me use occasionally at certain junctures the phrase that you, at a certain stage when freedom is ready to blossom, you can't not do it. It's that the negating willfulness no longer exists to not do it. So it's like you can't not do it. The second sloka. And notice that in the first sloka, a great deal has been said. 99% of the time spent on so-called spiritual matters in this world is wasted. Wasted. If you're going to remain on some geological terminal moraine, then it's a way of surviving, of adjusting and surviving and busying yourself, but it doesn't really go anywhere at all. It doesn't do anything. The second sloka, because the sannyasi of renunciation is also the yogi of holy work, and no man can be a yogi who surrenders not his earthly will. Because there's always a certain amount of egotistical pride. Oh, I'm doing this. I'm involved in this. Oh, look what we're doing. Well, it's like that in the facetious tone. That's the real character of it. So that the second sloka reads, because the sannyasi of renunciation is also the yogi of holy work, and no man can be a yogi who surrenders not his earthly will. Double negative here again. the Zahner translation, what men call renunciation is also spiritual exercise. And he puts in brackets here that the word can be spiritual exercise or it can also be practice. Either English phrase works. The ancient Greek word praktike is the equivalent of the Sanskrit here. Praktike is the complement to theoretike in Greek, practice and theoria, contemplation. What men call renunciation is also practice. You must know this. For without renouncing all set purpose, no one can act. You can't do anything. For real. Nothing really happens unless you really do it. And as long as you have some kind of a veil, thinking that you've done it because you're thinking about it, or that you're doing it because it conforms to the thought about it, that's not it really at all. And it gets very subtle because the images are so convincing. And when the images are powered by a powerful idea, it seems to be self-confirming. All of that is Maya. All of that is Maya. It just simply isn't the case at all. Third sloka. When the sage climbs the heights of yoga, he follows the path of work. But when he reaches the heights of yoga, he is in the land of peace. And I'll just continue reading it now so as not to tire you. And he reaches the heights of yoga when he surrenders his earthly will, when he is not bound by the work of his senses, and he is not bound by his earthly works. Arise, therefore, and with the help of thy spirit, lift up thy soul. Allow not thy soul to fall, for thy soul can be thy friend, and thy soul can be thy enemy. The soul of man is his friend when by the Spirit he has conquered his soul. But when a man is not lord of his soul, then this becomes his own enemy. When his soul is in peace, he is in peace, and then his soul is in God. In cold or in heat, in pleasure or in pain, in glory or disgrace, he is ever in him. When happy with vision and wisdom, he is the master of his own inner life. His soul sublime set on high, then he is called a yogi in harmony. To him, gold or stones or earth are one. He has risen on the heights of his soul, and in peace he beholds relatives, companions, and friends, those impartial or indifferent, or who hate him. He sees them all with the same inner peace. Day after day, let the yogi practice the harmony of soul in a secret place, in deep solitude, master of his mind, hoping for nothing, desiring nothing. Let him find a place that is pure and a seat that is restful, neither too high nor too low, the sacred grass and the skin and a cloth thereon. On that seat let him rest and practice yoga for the purification of the soul with the life of his body and mind in peace, his soul in silence before the one. We'll end there and we'll take a break, but you can see now that what we have begun, this is the first movement in making a big circle, so that we're going to make a big circle now, and we're making the circle with a blood current of feeling, but we're integrating with it at the center a pulse tone of consciousness. That all of this movement in a feeling tone that we've initiated now has a purpose which can be known. And if you do the whole, knowing the purpose, then you have really done it. And there is nothing in the universe that can negate that. Neither death, nor delusion, nor galactic scanning.